Our scripture reading this morning comes from the book of Matthew, chapter 20. From the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them into his vineyard. When he went out about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing a dial in the marketplace, and he said to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." So they went. When he went out again about noon and about 3 o'clock, he did the same. And about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, "Why are you standing here a dial all day?" They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard sent to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first." When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received the usual daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last worked only an hour, and you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the last will be the first, and the first will be the last. The word of God for us, the people of God.
Good morning, First Sun Chatham. It's awesome to be with you all this morning. Colin mentioned my main claim to fame is that I'm his wife. I'm Kincaid's mom, but I'm also an elder in the United Methodist Church, and I serve in a kind of strange way. I'm a pastor in a construction company, and so my title is actually more like chaplain. And I have a couple friends here with me from that setting. I work for a general contractor, and I'm there for the spiritual, emotional, and relational care of our employees. It's an awesome job. A lot of times I'm climbing a ladder on a job site and I am wondering how in the world pastoring took me to a ladder on a construction site. And so I thought when Colin invited me to preach that it was because maybe I'm uniquely qualified. Like I'm in a work setting, it's Labor Day weekend, and not just because it's Labor Day weekend and the attendance is a little light. Before I was a chaplain, I was a high school Spanish teacher. And I think about those days a lot. I loved teaching high school. High schoolers will just tell you like it is. They ask the question that everybody is thinking, everybody's wondering. And in Spanish 2, I did a simulation. We're in the recycling unit. And I did a simulation with the whole class where I divided them up into groups of 4 and gave them a list of resources that they needed to acquire in this simulation. And it was all, we were practicing vocabulary, we were practicing verb tense, they were demanding things, was the verb tense we were working with, and their job was to collect a certain number of resources amongst the whole class. But they didn't know who had what resources, and they didn't know what each started with, and they all started with different items. There was newspaper, there's cardboard, there's milk cartons, just all of that lovely recycling vocabulary. In doing this 16 times, I had one class to actually solve the simulation, which is to say I had one group of students who somehow ended up with everyone having everything that they needed. I had students in other classes who were like straight up stealing from each other. So it was a madhouse. Now, I love this kind of thing, like a simulation or a puzzle or a game or dystopian literature or like a dystopian movie like Hunger Games, or how many of you have seen Beast Games? It's like a new online, yeah, just Colin, okay. But I love this kind of thing because you find yourself knowing, you're kind of comparing yourself to the story you see before you even know it. And that's what a parable does. Like, you get the chance to compare yourself and wonder what you would do in that same situation before you even know it, you're on the hook with a parable. And this parable does that to us today. If you are seeing yourself in this parable, it's even valuable to see, like, where do I see myself? Who do I think I am in this parable? Do I think I am the worker who came first and is owed something? Do I think I'm the worker who came last and is surprised? Do I think I'm the generous landowner because I'm so wonderful and generous? Me, I'm bringing some elder brother energy from another parable you might remember, the prodigal son, where I often think I am owed something. I think I'm good. I love being good. I love checking the boxes and being approved of. And so I bring that energy that they see in this parable as well, of being owed something. We can easily find ourselves in this parable because Matthew's context is very similar to our context today. Matthew lived in a hierarchical, commercialized society where people wore jobs that we are even familiar with. We had some landowners, we had some artisans, some local business owners, some fishermen, folks that we still are practicing these professions. They did not have a middle class. So you had a few rich men and their families who ruled and contained all of the wealth of the society, and then you had the lower class. And so all of those professions that I named would be a part of the lower class, even landowners and local business people. Knowing this, it's not a stretch to say that in that society, what you did, your job, told us a lot about your value, told us a lot about your worth and where you stood in this hierarchy of society. And it is uncomfortably similar for our society today. So when you meet somebody, the first thing you do, and even the first thing I did in the sermon is I tell you what I did, right? You introduce yourself, hi, my name's Brittany Apshire-Bear, I am da-da-da, and you tell them what they do, or you ask, well, so what do you do? I think part of this is we're curious about each other's lives. We wanna know something about what interests you, or who are you, or what makes up your day, but that's a little awkward to say, right? So we say, what do you do? Colin, I gotta give Colin props because during the pandemic, he's always worked very closely with young adults, but during the pandemic, lots of folks were graduating into the workforce that and weren't able to get jobs. And so he shifted that question a little. He said, instead of what do you do, he said, what occupies your time? I thought that is a really beautiful way of saying, like, what we're actually interested in. That's a more helpful thing. Like, tell me something about who you are based on how you spend your time, what you're interested in. But we live in a society that loves to work, and we think it tells us a lot about who we are. The cliche saying is that Europeans work to live, and folks in the United States, we live to work, right? Being immersed in a corporate setting, I get to see this up close. I get to see a lot of the different ways that we use work. We use work to find friends. We use work to maybe find a partner or a spouse. We use work to figure out what it means to be a teammate. And all of these things are really beautiful that come out of work. They can be really enhancing of our lives. I also see and I feel personally when we use work to soothe. Like if something isn't going well at home or something's a little more complicated at home, we might find ourselves overworking or spending extra hours there because it's easier to knock something off of that task list in the office than it might be to work out something at home. I'm the first to say I've held almost all of the positions that you can hold that are identity-driven positions, right? Like I told you that up front, I was a teacher, I was a pastor, I'm a pastor in a weird way now, and kind of my last hat, my ultimate identity-driven hat is that I'm a mom. And all of these things, we feel a sense of identity. And I'm the first to say I feel that. I really think we pastors are the worst at it. Like we have the ultimate card, the wild card of saying like, I'm working for God. So you can't question how I work. This is precious. This is off limits, right? We are answering God's call. We get kind of precious about our work. And I don't blame us. When I first started working at Brassfield & Gorrie, couple of these people in here are going to know who I'm talking about. I will not name names. I walked into my office and I had a single typed sheet of paper of quotes, Now, the context was I was working with the other chaplains in the company to lead a study. We do book studies and Bible studies across construction sites. And I was in the middle of a study called A Life That We Can Live. And this study was created out of a response from some surveys that our company had done saying we really struggle with work-life balance. If any of y'all work in construction or adjacent to construction, you know it is a grind. And so we had created this study, and in the middle of the study, I walk in and there's a sheet, an anonymous sheet, of single typed quotes about the moral value of work. Like how work makes us good. Clearly I had touched a nerve. And there were things like, there's no magic to achievement. It's really about hard work, choices, and persistence, from Michelle Obama. Or Andrew Carnegie said, there is no substitute for hard work. Booker T. Washington said, nothing ever comes to one that's worth having except as a result of hard work. I was a little surprised to get this put on my desk, and I was a little bit like, well, what do you expect, Britt? Like, when you put the gospel up against the gospel of a work ethic, it is challenging. And it's what this parable is talking about today. It's something deeper than just work, right? Like, we can feel it when we hear this parable. It's the context of the parable. Work is the context of the parable, but it's like the context of the simulation or of the game. It's not about the context. The context just shows us something that's true. It's something underneath, something that's actually being challenged. And that thing that is challenged is a value system. It's a value system that's one of the first that we learn. It is the if-then value system. And honestly, it helps a lot, right? I was talking with some parents in the hallway. We're teaching Kincaid the if-then value system. If you hit, then you will go to Cozy. If you clean up your plate and put it in the dishwasher, then you can have dessert, right? Like, these are helpful if-thens. The question of the parable is a little bit harder. It is, which if-then will you choose to live your life by? Which, if then, will you find is the truest one, the one that you actually want to shape your life by? Is it the input equals output formula? Is it the one that says, if you work hard, then you'll achieve anything you put your mind to? Is it the one that says, if you work hard, then success will follow? If you work hard, you'll be rewarded? If you work hard, your efforts will pay off, or your dreams will become a reality, or you'll get ahead, or good things will happen. Or do I live my life like the formula that Jesus ascribes to is the truer one? The one that says a lot less logical things. Things like in the Beatitudes we hear, you're blessed when you're at the end of your rope. With less of you, there is more of God and God's rule. Or you're blessed when you're content with just who you are, no more, no less. Then you find yourselves the proud owners of everything that can't be bought. Or later in Matthew, it says, God causes it to rain on the just and the unjust. That's the translation we're most familiar with. Or another one says, God gives God's best, the sun to warm and the rain to nourish, to everyone. To everyone regardless, the good and the bad, the nice and the nasty. God is taking our neat little categories and at the very least shaking them up, I think probably throwing them out. I've witnessed this in a close way with the life of someone I've worked with for about 6 years. He was in his first job, about 21 years old, and graduated to come to work for Brassfield and Gorey, and I met him in a hospital bed. Over the past 6 years, he has gone to see every specialist out there. Like, if there's a specialist in what we think he might have, then he's seen him. He's been to NIH, he's been to the Mayo Clinic, he's been to UNC with incredible doctors there, and they have told him over and over again for 6 years that they can't put their finger on their diagnosis. Last weekend, his wife gathered some friends and family, and we came to pray over him as he went this past week to another specialist. He went to UAB, and someone in the room said, I know you must feel so alone. And this person said, I don't. I look around and I see all of these people here in this room, and I know I'm not alone in this. And I know it's weird to say that, but I didn't feel that way before I got sick. Now, I hesitate to tell you this story at all. I think there are lots of stories out there that are about suffering, that glorify suffering, and there's some bad theology around suffering and what it does in our lives. That when we focus just on the suffering, or say, like, we couldn't have learned that about God were it not for the suffering, I think we're actually missing the point. The point is the God who comes close in that suffering. That is the glorious thing. It's not the suffering, but the God who enters in. Eugene Peterson says, Jesus is the descent of God into our lives, into our real lives just as they are, not the ascent of our lives into God. But that thing, that question that comes up, if it comes up for you like it does for me when I hear this, is tricky, right? Like, what do we do with that logic of the cross put against this logic of an if-then, an input-output, a good work ethic earns you a good life? It's tricky. It is easier to live into the if-then of if you work hard, then life will be good to you. And that's really why we resist this parable. This parable challenges not only our systems of work or worth and value, but our systems of predictability and our sense of control. It is hard to hear that earning isn't real. Jesus takes our if-then logic, our logic that says we earned it, it says that we are owed it, and he asks, are you envious because I'm generous? And he just cuts through it. Jesus knew that for his hearers, he was up against a deeply ingrained way of thinking, a thought that probably came from the same as Kincaid, the time that they were yay high, and he was undoing a teaching as well as shaping a new one. So we know when we read this, the level that it bothers us, it can't just be about work. It has to be about something more. It rubs me just wrong enough. I can feel the same complaint of the laborers welling up in me when I read it. And our complaining can reveal a lot. So I'll reread Matthew 20, 8 through 12. It says, when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first. Now, I think Jesus is intentionally stirring the pot. I think he is setting us up. When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now, when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received the usual daily wage. And this is the kicker, this is the complaint. When they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us. This is about identity. This is not only about work. This is about the thing that gets shown when we see any identity system that causes feelings of entitlement or owing to bubble up within us, or any feeling of I've earned it to bubble up within us, or any pressure to earn it to bubble up. Yet somehow, again, Jesus has skillfully shown us it can't be either or. It can't be that we're owed something, we're not owed anything from God, and it can't be that we're earning something. The goodness of God far surpasses anything you or I have ever earned. So it has to be a third thing. I love a third thing. Not just a God, not just a human, but a God-human. Jesus strikes at our neat divisions yet again. And that third thing is gift. It is gift. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Asked the generous landowner. God over and over again shows us a generosity that does not make sense. It is not logical. God turns death into life, despair into hope, chaos into order. God makes the first last, and the last first, and the last first, and the first last, so that finally, when all is said and done, we get to experience the fullness of the relief of grace. It does not depend on us. It never did. Thanks be to God.